It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Ramadan began about 10 days ago. A guest tells us about the event and how to support Muslim community members while they're fasting.
First, lawmakers in the state assembly may have reached an impasse when it comes to Wisconsin's next budget.
Among the issues facing lawmakers are disagreements over transportation funding, money for schools, and more. And disagreements among Republicans at the state capitol are complicating matters in the legislature.
Laurel White is with us now. She's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Laurel, where does the state budget stand right now?
Well, we had a pretty interesting day in the Capitol today with a lot of back and forth, and the real focus today was K-12 education funding. So the Assembly GOP actually released their plan, their kind of standalone plan for K-12 education funding in Wisconsin today, and it departs from what the governor proposed in his budget in some pretty important ways. It spends about $90 million less than the governor proposes in his budget, which is a pretty important point because the governor has been traveling around the state for the past several weeks promoting his education budget. It's a really marquee issue for him in this budget cycle. He's proposing about $640 million in education funding increases. Of course, that's not just K-12. That includes like the UW system and other elements of what the state pays into education. But Assembly Republicans coming out and saying that they want to spend $90 million less than the governor is a pretty big departure. So we got that information today, and that started kind of another spiral of disagreement, you might say, on an important part of the budget.
Well, and in terms of how the assembly wanted to help offset that reduction from the governor's plan, it involves raising taxes.
It does. So one of the important parts of the Assembly Republican plan is to allow what they're calling frugal or low spending school districts to raise property taxes. So right now there are revenue limits on school districts across the state. It's about $9,100. So what the Assembly GOP plan would do would raise that revenue limit to $9,800. And they say that that's going to help districts that really have been spending much less than others across the state to increase their funding and just have more of an investment in education. But this property tax disagreement is really thorny, and it kind of ties into other things that the governor has been talking about in terms of how property taxes and other taxes play into things like the transportation budget, for example. So we're really getting to the point in the state budget where you're noticing how things are very connected, and all the things that we're discussing right now are connected in very important ways, and they're touching on a lot of the areas of disagreement.
Well, and school funding, one right now and the other, which has been sort of the elephant in the room, but it is one everybody's talking about, is transportation funding and how failure to come to an agreement on that has been sowing discords within the Republican Party.
That's right. So the governor has been doing kind of some kind of reminiscent of his trips around the state that I talked about his investment in education. He mentioned the other day, I think he's done about 40 or 50 stops on his education budget around the state. Reminiscent of that, he started doing stops around the state about the transportation budget now. And he has these big placards that say, get it done. And that's his message, is let's get this transportation budget done. Let's not go past the June 30th deadline, because that would impact some projects that we have going on. Essentially, let's just take my budget proposal and run with it. So he's going public in a way about the transportation budget that he had been going about the education budget in recent weeks, which is interesting.
We're talking with Laurel White right now, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, and she's giving us an update on the impasse in the state assembly and senate over the proposed state budget. And Laurel, raising taxes. So you said education was a marquee item for the governor this year. So is the pledge to not raise taxes. And when we look at education, at least the assembly's plan, and when we look at some of the disagreement over the transportation budget, both of these issues also touch on taxes. Can you unweave that for us a little bit?
Sure. So I'll do the transportation budget first because it's a little bit easier to explain at this point. And then I can get into the K-12 funding and taxes that we got some more information on today, which is pretty interesting. So the tax hang-up in regards to the transportation budget is really that Assembly Republicans in particular want the governor and others to consider raising the gas tax or vehicle registration fees. And they really want to do that because they want to spend more money on road construction projects and road repairs, and they also want to lower the level of bonding or borrowing that the governor has in his budget. So the governor has been very adamant about the gas tax in particular. He's gone so far as to say that he would veto a budget that has a gas tax increase in it. It took him a little bit longer to get that specific about the vehicle registration fee issue, but now he's come out and said that he certainly doesn't support that either. So kind of those new revenue opportunities that Assembly Republicans have floated have been quashed essentially by the governor and many Senate Republicans. So there's that tax issue for the transportation budget. Now, where education is concerned, it gets a little bit wonkier because what's going on with education funding, interestingly, the proposal that we saw today from Assembly Republicans would actually lower property taxes. So they would lower property taxes from the level that property taxes are today. And they're really touting this plan as, you know, its ability to do that. But that does not meet a standard that the governor has set as he's traveled around talking about this budget. He actually wants property taxes to be below 2014 levels. So we're working here essentially with how much property taxes should be lowered. The governor wants to meet a standard in 1 year. And Assembly Republicans seem to be fine with meeting a standard of, hey, it's at least lower than right now. So we're working on a property tax reduction no matter what, at least as of what it's looking right now. But it's how much lower is it going to be?
Now, looking at the state's budget writing committee, John Nygren, who's on that committee, has said that he wants to go to bat for rural schools and low-income schools. So how might that preference play out?
Yeah, so he did say, I think he said yesterday that he could be, quote, pretty stubborn about some of these changes. And I think what he's referencing there when he's talking about supporting rural schools is lifting that revenue limit, because a lot of the rural districts in the state have stuck with that 9,100 revenue limit. And the Assembly GOP plan, as I mentioned before, would lift that to 9,800. So I think Representative Nygren saying that he could potentially be pretty stubborn about this assembly plan could be challenging, because interestingly, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald actually issued a statement on the assembly GOP plan before it was even completely rolled out. It was about 5 minutes before the press conference from Assembly Republicans, and Senator Scott Fitzgerald released a statement that said, I'll just go ahead and read it if you don't mind. He says, the state Senate remains committed to fully funding K-12 education as Governor Walker proposed in his administrative budget. We'll continue to look for ways to support low spending districts, but a proposal that raises property taxes and picks winners and losers within our school districts is a move away from the position of both the governor and the Senate Republican caucus. The assembly package that was endorsed today is simply not the direction that this budget is headed. So very strong language there from Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald denouncing the plan before it was even officially rolled out. And you'll notice his language there. He said raises property taxes. So I think Assembly Republicans would push back and say this does lower property taxes from current levels. But again, it's not lowering them to those 2014 levels that the governor is interested in. So we have some really stark disagreements happening between not only the governor and the assembly, but the Senate and the assembly.
So what happens in a scenario like this, Laurel, where you have Republicans in the Senate and the assembly at odds with each other, seemingly both sticking by their individual plans? What sorts of moves could we expect to see next?
Well, there was a little bit of discussion yesterday about the Senate actually breaking out and doing its own budget. which would be something that we certainly haven't seen, at least in recent years. And that kind of came up because the Joint Finance Committee, so Senate and Assembly, their representatives on the Finance Committee were scheduled to meet today. And they weren't actually able to hold that meeting because there was some kind of behind the scenes disagreements, and they'll only come out and vote on things when they've generally been agreed upon. So Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald was asked about this lack of a meeting today. And he said, you know, I'm optimistic. I'm hoping that the Finance Committee will be able to meet as scheduled on Thursday. But if they're unable to meet then, we might need to consider breaking the budget away from committee and working on our own fiscal plan. Because he said his exact words would be, if they don't meet on Thursday, then we're in a rougher spot than I thought we were. So this is language, this is a concept that is really pretty unique. As I mentioned before, we haven't seen this in recent years. And Speaker Voss from the Assembly weighed in on this today and used pretty strong language. He said that the senator saying that they might do their own budget over in the Senate was essentially a threat to the Assembly. And Speaker Voss said, I'm not going to make threats. If the Senate wants to do that, that would be really unfortunate. So, and Speaker Voss reiterated shortly after he said that, that he really wants to get together, the Assembly really wants to get together and meet and discuss issues like transportation and K-12 funding with the Senate. But we certainly haven't gotten any indication, at least officially, that those meetings are scheduled at this point.
Well, we'll be watching what happens. And of course, the governor has that veto pen. Laurel, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White, State Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She was with us to give us an update on the impasse over the proposed state budget. Many Muslims around the world are currently observing Ramadan, which began at the end of May. During this time, Muslims fast, avoid negative habits, and spend a lot of time in prayer and reflection.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic calendar, which is based on phases of the moon. And when a calendar is based on phases of the moon, the months fall during different seasons each year. A couple years ago, Ramadan began in the winter. Now it's in the warmer months.
If you're not fasting over the next 28 days or so yourself, you might have friends or coworkers who are observing the holiday at a challenging time of year. Our next guest wrote an article on ways to support friends and colleagues in the middle of the fast.
Janella Massa talked to us last year about Ramadan. She's a Toronto-based reporter who's also Canada's first hijab-wearing TV news reporter. She wrote the article, How You Can Help Your Colleagues During Ramadan, for the Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail. Janella, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how do you personally feel observing Ramadan affect you at work? No eating, no drinking through the day.
Well, you know, it's kind of one of those things where you have to find the balance, because a lot of people probably think that Muslims dread Ramadan. It's this big, daunting challenge that we have to undertake for a month of fasting every day from before dawn until sunset. But it's something I actually look forward to, and a lot of Muslims look forward to, because you get together with family and you know, it's a moment for self-reflection. It's a time to think about those less fortunate. So there are some benefits. But at work, obviously, can be a little bit of a challenge. It depends on what kind of work you do. I always say the biggest challenge is not so much not eating, but the low energy that comes along with it. So I always find that I start to hit that wall in the afternoon, as most people do, when you might grab a snack. So for me, you know, and for my colleagues, they might notice that I get a little less chatty, a little, trying to conserve my energy and just kind of trying to get my work done quietly at my desk and not exert too much energy.
A lot of people don't necessarily want to bring up issues of religion and faith at a workplace, but does it help to talk about these things with coworkers, maybe bosses, to see how best to work with each other during this time?
I think absolutely, because, you know, on the one hand, fasting is a very personal thing. You know, you may not even realize that somebody is fasting until, you know, you get into an awkward situation where you invite them for lunch, or maybe there's cake in the boardroom and they say, oh, no, I'm sorry, I'm fasting. And that might be the first moment and you don't know what to do. So it is a good idea to open up that line of conversation and ask questions, because they also want to be able to perform well in the workplace. They don't want the fast to affect their workplace. But there are things that an employer can do, say, to help them out, depending on the type of work that they're in. So, you know, your employee may ask, to shift their work hours to earlier in the day or later in the day. Or they may ask, you know, I don't need the full lunch hour because I'm not eating lunch. Can I just work through lunch and leave an hour early? Or can I work from home if that's an option? So kind of being mindful of the very long day that they're going to have and if they have the option to, you know, move their shift around. The other piece is if they're in a job that is obviously very physically strenuous, you know, that's something to keep in mind. If there is an option for the tasks that are going to be assigned, you know, if there is an option to give them a task indoors or that is less strenuous physically, so they can kind of conserve some of that energy, I'm sure they would really appreciate that.
Yeah, suppose there's a manager, a boss somewhere out there who's thinking, okay, I know I have some employees who are going to be observing Ramadan. I don't know what I could do to help. I'd like to, without getting into legal ramifications, which could be a whole different conversation.
Sure.
But if there's that boss, how do they make that approach? How do they talk to their employees to figure out what's going to work?
Yeah, I think the best thing is to ask them, you know, is there anything that I can do to help make your fast easier? As I mentioned, you know, giving them those options, those flexibility. Here's what we can do. You know, let's put you on an evening shift so you can sleep in the morning and start your day later since you won't break the fast until 9 o'clock in some cities. So I think actually asking them if there's anything that can be done so that you can come to a compromise together about what works best. And you know what? Some people, you know, if their job really is something that's physically strenuous, you know, if they're a construction worker, if they're a firefighter, or they're an athlete, they may decide not to fast. So that's something to keep in mind, too, that not everybody fasts. People don't fast for a number of reasons, and there are a number of exemptions for fasting. If you're sick, pregnant, breastfeeding, you know, all of these kinds of things. So some people may actually choose not to fast, and they can give to charity instead. So also don't assume that everyone's fasting.
So maybe non-Muslims don't step up and help police your Muslim coworkers on their
exactly.
fasting.
This is not the time to become the fasting police. If you see someone eating a sandwich, don't shame them. you know, women don't fast when they're menstruating. So a lot of women often have that awkward conversation where they were fasting and then suddenly they're eating their lunch and their coworker comes and says, hey, I thought you were fasting. You know, that might not be something that
well,
they want to divulge. If they're taking medication because they're sick, you know, maybe they don't want to divulge their health issues. So, you know, yeah, don't become the fasting police if you see someone who is not fasting.
Talking to Janella Massa, she's a reporter in Toronto. Her piece in the Globe and Mail there titled How You Can Help Your Colleagues During Ramadan. Let's stay with those colleagues. Don't police the fasting. Got it. Are there, maybe I don't want to judge them, stupid questions, unpleasant things to bring up, maybe that people should steer clear of when
talking
about Ramadan?
Well, I always say no question is stupid. I'm sure most Muslims would prefer that you ask them. They won't be offended. If you are, they probably will tell you. Don't be afraid to ask. The one thing I always say is, like, don't feel like you can't eat in front of me. Don't feel sorry for me. Don't apologize if you offered me your wife's homemade brownies and you forgot that I was fasting. It's okay. We've chosen to fast, and we know that the world will go on without us. We will be okay. We will live. So enjoy your lunch and don't, you know, don't feel like you have to hide in the corner if you're, you know, enjoying a snack at your desk. It's fine.
Now you get to look forward to something fun at the end. It sounds like Eid. Am I saying that right? The festival
yes,
after
is,
Ramadan ends?
That's right. So there are actually two Eids in the Islamic faith. This is one of them. The other one is the pilgrimage to Mecca for Hajj. So this is Eid al-Fitr. Essentially, you would usually go for prayer in the morning. You would visit family and friends. You give to charity on Eid. If we're talking about the workplace, one thing that's a little bit tricky because you mentioned the lunar calendar, the end of the month or the beginning of the month is marked by the birth of the new moon. So you would see the tiny sliver of moon in the sky. And sometimes there's some discrepancy as to whether it was seen or not. So you may have people who are celebrating Eid on two different days, like a Monday or a Tuesday. Or your employee might tell you, you know, I need Eid off so I can celebrate with my family, but I don't know yet what it's going to be. I'm going to have to tell you the day before. So that's something that's a little bit tricky, but yeah, usually Eid is celebrated with family and friends. You get to enjoy your reward after fasting for 30 days and eating lots of treats and gifts and, you know, money for the young children and also a donation to charity.
Janella, I hate to ask you this in the middle of a fasting day, but what kind of foods do you look forward to on that Eid celebration?
I will tell you that when you're fasting, everything tastes more delicious when you break your fast. So it really does not matter what it is. Everything tastes delicious at iftar time. That's the time that you eat your meal. So usually when I start to get to the part of the day where I'm starting to fade is when I start thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner and dreaming up all of the things that I'm going to eat. I know that, lots of people have traditional foods, but it totally varies because Muslims come from such a huge, diverse ethnic background. So everyone has their ethnic foods that they love, and it might be different. There's no one kind of food, but everyone usually does break their fast with dates. That's a very common thing that you'll find in a Muslim household during Ramadan.
Janella, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Janella Massa. She's a Toronto-based reporter who wrote the article, How You Can Help Your Colleagues During Ramadan, for the Globe and Mail. First, the phrases alternative facts and fake news have been used a lot during this presidential administration. The president has accused news outlets of lying and making stuff up. Critics of President Trump point toward multiple fact checks, rating his statements as false. And of course, lying isn't just in the world of politics. It's part of all our lives, starts in our cognitive development as children, too.
Our next guest says lying is just part of being human. Udijit Bhattacharjee joins us now. He's the author of Why We Lie in this month's National Geographic. You can find a link to that article on the Central Time Facebook page. He's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Spy Who Couldn't Spell. Udijit, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Veronica.
Well, you write that to lie is human. Maybe not the prettiest way of thinking about what it means to be human, but apparently it's true. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that we are sort of programmed to develop the capacity for lying at a very early age. And this is sort of a muscle that we use throughout our lives in small and big ways. And we all do it. Lying is universal, it's natural, and we have to come to terms with it.
It's something that has been in the forethought of a lot of people's minds over the last year or two. And you write that our ability as a society to separate truth from lies is under unprecedented threat. Can you tell us why that is?
Well, there's two aspects to this. The first is, of course, what I just mentioned, that we have this intrinsic kind of nature to lie on occasion. And along with that, we're also extremely gullible because we also have an extremely trusting nature. So when you put those two things together, we're already in trouble. Now, add to that social media and the technologies of today, where you can spread information rapidly with the click of a mouse or the tap of a finger, and you've got a very kind of a unique situation that we haven't seen before in history, where people can push out alternative facts or plain falsehoods, and there'll be lots of takers for these falsehoods. And once you get an army of people believing these false claims, then it's very hard to erase those from the public discourse.
You profile a bunch of, I guess we could just call them liars, in your magazine article, starting with a student at Princeton who seemed very unusual, enigmatic, accomplished, and it turned out he was all false. It was all a lie. Can you tell us about him?
Yes. So this is, this is somebody whose story has been told a few times before. His real name is James Hogue, and he was most recently arrested, probably for the sixth or seventh time, late last year from Colorado. Back in 1988 or 89, it was that he applied to enter Princeton University. And he wrote this application essay in which he claimed that he was a rancher. He had grown up really without parents, and he'd read philosophy under the stars. He was completely self-taught, and he was actually a champion runner. So that part of his resume was true, but everything else was made up. But Princeton fell for this story because it just seemed so enigmatic, so charming, so extraordinary, and Princeton wanted to live up to this idea that that they were looking for talent everywhere, not just from prep schools. And so in 1.5 years, he was recognized as a former convict. He had stolen bicycle parts, and he had been arrested, and he had been running from the law, and his story fell apart. So that's just one of the examples that I present in this story about liars.
And each of the people you profile is lying for a different reason. And it turns out there are a lot of different reasons that people may lie, but there are clusters that are a little more popular among them to benefit ourselves and to avoid some sort of negative consequence. So could you talk a little bit about why we lie?
Well, so the simple answer is that we lie because we want to protect our interest in some form or another. And usually we're lying because we want to cover up for mistakes that we've made that we're ashamed of, or mistakes that we know are going to lead to some serious penalty. We also lie to gain unjust rewards. CEOs of companies will lie to their shareholders so that they can hoodwink them into keeping their money in the company, which may be going bankrupt. We also lie to inflate our sort of sense of self-worth. We lie to create a false impression that may or may not be linked to a financial incentive, but simply because we want to impress other people. Those are just some of the bigger reasons why we lie. And then you have people who just tell malicious lies to hurt the reputation of other people. It may or may not be linked to their self-interest, and yet they do it. So there are all these reasons why people lie.
We're talking with Udijit Bhattacharjee right now, the author of Why We Lie in this month's National Geographic magazine. And Udijit, it's interesting. You look at when we first begin to lie, and there's an interesting spread. There's a graphic in your article that shows us when lying seems to peak for most of us. So can you talk about that kind of arc of lying?
Well, so children start lying, at the age of 3, 4, or 5, and they're not very good liars to begin with. But by the time they're 10, 11, they become quite skilled at lying. It turns out that lying is something of a cognitive milestone for developing kids. Once kids reach adolescence, in the teenage years, the lying seems to peak, and then it kind of drops down again when they're full-blown adults, but then pretty much remains constant up through later in life.
Do the brains of people who are more habituated, more used to lying, do they look different than people's brains who don't lie quite as often?
Yeah, you bring up a reference to an interesting study that I cover in the story. Researchers found that people who lie frequently and tell sort of big lies tend to have more white matter in their brains. Now, white matter is really the fibers that connect various nerve cells. And one takeaway from that study is the possibility that those who lie habitually have greater connectivity within their brains, allowing them to think up lies more quickly and readily than the rest of us. And then the other sort of possible interpretation of this is that that the habitual lying, or the lying habit itself, may be the cause for this kind of extra connectivity. But yes, you're right. Studies have found that liars, habitual liars, have brains that look somewhat different.
So a lot of interesting research surrounding why we lie, and you also write about one that looks at people who have to solve some math problems, and then they get paid based on how many they say they got right. What did we find out there?
Well, so this was a study that was done by a researcher at Duke University named Dan Ariely, and he sort of created this test where, you know, people got 20 or so questions or 10 questions. These were like simple math problems, but they took time and they had limited time. Each of the subjects had limited time. And so there was this tendency among subjects, no matter where this experiment was conducted, across cultures, countries, to inflate the number of problems that they got right when they were, you know, they had a chance to self-report how many problems they were able to solve. So there was this sort of, you know, this X factor, this cheating that went on among subjects, which was initially surprising to Dan. But then later on, he was surprised by the fact that that subjects didn't lie any more than usual when the financial incentive for lying was increased.
Well, and it's also interesting, just briefly, that we don't, that we lie even when we think we don't lie. We think, I'm someone who tells the truth, but if you actually kept a journal, it seems as though probably most of us are telling a couple lies maybe a day.
Yeah, you know, this was first sort of documented close to 25 years ago. There's a researcher named Bella DiPaolo out in California who was the first one to sort of systematically study how frequently people lie. So all these subjects, you know, maintained journals. They were asked to note down the lies that they had said through the day. And it turned out that that most people were lying at least twice or maybe more through the day, and that it was quite frequent. Now, granted, most of these lies were smaller lies, you know, told to spare the feelings of others. You know, if it was a girl rejecting a boy, you know, if she didn't want to go on a date with him, then she might say, "I'm busy," you know, that sort of lie. But there were also bigger lies, you know, things like, "I'm sick today and so I can't come into work," you know, which is a lie that I think many of us are familiar with because we've told it.
We're talking right now to Udijit Bhattacharjee, author of Why We Lie. That's featured in this month's National Geographic magazine.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about why we lie? Why do you think people lie? Do you agree that lying is part of being human? If you've lied about something big or small, why did you do it? How often do you think you lie and why? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up the conversation and get to your calls in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our discussion now with Udijit Bhattacharjee, who wrote the cover story for the National Geographic June issue. It's called Why We Lie.
You can join in now with your questions and your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How often do you lie? Why do you do it? Is it okay to tell that innocent? Is it innocent lie to spare someone's feelings? Do you find it easy to forgive people who have lied to you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And you did it at the end of your article. You're very sharing of yourself in this piece. You share a couple lies that you've told and things that you get wrong. And one of them is that you share an article that you later find out to be false, to not be good journalism and probably not to be based in fact. But you use it as an example about why it's so hard for us to change someone's mind, even when a lie, for example, might be exposed. Can you tell us about what you did and what it says about the way our brains latch on to what we believe?
Well, this is one of the counterintuitive things that I learned in the course of researching the article. I've been puzzled in the past few months that there are certain false claims that have been made in the media about the inauguration crowds, for example, at President Trump's inauguration. Things like that even go back further, like the lie about President Obama having been born outside of the United States, that have lingered in public memory, and they've been debunked time and again. President Obama even put out his birth certificate eventually, and even then, there were people who refused to believe it. So what I learned is that even when you debunk a false claim over and over, that really doesn't do the job of erasing it from the public's mind. As long as you have some people who still believe it, they'll continue to believe it and they'll continue to propagate it. And the reason is that we tend to not be completely neutral when it comes to absorbing facts. We have a worldview and it slants one way or another, and because of our prejudices, we tend to give more credence to news or information that seems to fit our prejudices. And once we've absorbed that information, and it's gotten embedded into our psyche, then even when we're confronted with evidence to the contrary, just clear, unambiguous evidence, we still sometimes will continue to believe what, the false information that we were fed earlier. I could tell you, there was a story that I came across on social media about India's Congress Party, which is India's oldest political party, having been ranked as the most corrupt political party, among 10 sort of really corrupt political parties across the world, from China, from Russia, and so on. And I believed it. I posted it to a social media group that I'm a part of because I thought it was true. And I thought it was true because I'm not fond of the Congress Party. And I do think that they've indulged in corruption, and but it turns out that this particular news article was fake news, and it had been written up on a website called BBC News or something like that, that sounded authentic, that sounded like an extension of the British Broadcasting Corporation, and it really wasn't. So I sort of posted an apology and said, look, I posted to my social media group saying, this is fake news. I'm sorry, I withdraw this. And yet, days after I'd posted that, the same link was being forwarded on the same group as if the debunking had never taken place. And this seemed to fit exactly what researchers have told me about the problem that we face today in debunking fake news and countering it.
Let's go to our callers now as we talk with Udijit Bhattacharjee, author of Why We Lie, in this month's National Geographic. We've got Mona on the line in Madison. Mona, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about the difference in biological changes between hanging on to one great big lie for years and years versus just daily repeating, common white lies like, oh, you look fabulous, when she doesn't, or something like that. It seems to me there'd be a difference, because that big lie kind of like would eat at you or something and do other damage to your body, I would think.
Mona, thanks a lot for that question. And Udijit, do we know anything about the effect on the brain, or psychologically anyway, of a small white lie versus kind of a whopper?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't have a direct answer to it, but I can sort of provide two insights that might address it indirectly. The first is something that I cover in the piece, which is that small lies kind of often pave the way to bigger lies. So once you get used to telling smaller lies, the brain somehow adapts and has less of a response to telling bigger lies. So there you have it. I mean, this is in the neuroscience literature. There's some kind of an attenuating response of the brain to lying. To the question of you know, small white lies that we tell every day, I think we do make a distinction. We know that that lies really, you know, the gravity of a lie depends on the intention behind telling it. You know, a lie could destroy a marriage if it's a big dark secret that one spouse is keeping from the other. And you know, and a white lie like, "Oh, you look great in that dress," might actually go a little bit, you know, towards saving your marriage. So there's clearly sort of a difference between those two lies. But I do know that that for big lies, you know, there's self-deception at work. I mean, people are able to rationalize these huge lies by compartmentalizing everything else that's going on in their lives from this big secret that they're keeping from others, and they manage to convince themselves, they manage to rationalize that they're doing it for some bigger cause. You know, so every lie has its own set of rationalizations, no matter how acceptable or unacceptable they might be when looked at objectively.
And Tim from Marinette is next. Tim, we're pretty short on time, so just briefly, please.
Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering what your guests thought about this kind of a psychological evaluation, but when my kids were little, my son was about 8, my daughter was about 4, and we were missing $5, and I knew my son had taken it, and I peeked around the corner, and he flipped it out of his pants to have his younger sister find it. Mm. So when I saw that, I approached him, and I said, "You know, I know that you took it." And he kept denying it and lying. And I said, "You know, I'm not upset that you stole it." And he looked at me very strange. I said, "What I'm upset with is that you lied."
Well, Tim, thanks for that story. And you did it. We've got about 10 seconds. What do you hear in that?
Well, you know, I think that's a familiar sounding story to many parents. I know that I've told my son and my daughter several times that it's really the cover up that I'm worried about, not the actual bad behavior or bad conduct. But you know, children will be children, and it's easy for us to say, tell the truth always. Mm-hmm. But there are times when they're going to lie. And I think we have to live with that.
Udijit, thanks so much for joining us. That was Udijit Bhattacharjee, author of Why We Lie in this month's National Geographic magazine.
My God, we're defenseless, like fish in a barrel.
Options?
My instinct is to hide in this barrel, like the wily fish.
That's Captain Zap Brannigan hatching another brilliant plan there on the animated series Futurama.
I've never heard that. That was pretty funny.
It's one of my favorite clips, actually.
Listen. Diehard fans of this show, they're worried, though. It's been available on Netflix for a long time, I guess. But now, when viewers pull up an episode from the first 5 seasons, they get a message that it will be removed from the service at the beginning of July.
It's not clear who's pulling the plug, Netflix itself or the creator of the show, 20th Century Fox. But there has been a big online backlash against the decision.
It's a new feature of watching TV in the 21st century. Unlimited access to shows until the access is limited again.
Yeah, and I've gotten rid of, DVDs of shows that I've, watched over the years, thinking, okay, well, it's available for streaming if I want to go back and watch it. But it's available today. That doesn't mean it's going to be available next year or next, you know, next month for that matter.
Right. This happens. I guess we were hearing Buffy the Vampire Slayer is another example. I thought I heard a rumor that Arrested Development was also a similar situation. And I, by the way, am not done watching that yet.
Yeah, it's so... binge watch. You're taking the day off tomorrow.
Yep,
you're
going to
just
gone.
Watch
I'm
all
gonna
of them.
I'm going to be homesick.
All right. Well, good luck catching up. I did watch all of Futurama on Netflix before it went away, actually. So I'm lucky there. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.